Okay, thank you. In the last talk, you heard about cases when metadata was not available. I'm going to take a different tack and back up to cases when the actual data are not available. And I was inspired in this by a quote from former U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, who was largely mocked for this quote that it was seen as deliberately cryptic, although the quote was actually defended by linguists such as Jeffrey Pullum. And I may disagree with Mr. Rumsfeld's politics, but I think this terminology is useful for what I'm about to describe. And that's namely the question of when do we know that a language has been documented? And here I'm not talking about the question of documentation versus description. That's an ongoing debate that has been discussed at this conference and 2 years ago also at the first iteration of this conference. But I'm asking really the more mundane question is, are the data there? This may seem like a trivial question, but actually I think it lies at the heart of our field. For example, even if you apply for funding to document an endangered language, the one thing you want to justify is that this language needs to be documented. That is, that there aren't already data there. So there are some standard answers to this question. Language X has a dictionary, or language X has a grammar, right, that's been documented. Some linguists worked with the language. Somebody funded a project on that language, so it must be documented. I think a better answer is much more pragmatic, is that can we find the data? Right? Are the primary data things like recordings, field notes, transcriptions, lexical data, etc., are these things available and are they accessible? That really should be the standard by which we judge whether a language has been documented. Sorry, I forgot to start my watch, so.
That's fine.
Yeah, I'll just have to take that time out of my head there. Okay, so returning now to the unknowns problem, as stated by Rumsfeld. Using this Rumsfeldian terminology, we can break this problem down into two parts. Okay? So first you have the known unknowns. Okay? These are the things where the languages for which we know that there is no documentation. These are like the blank spots on the map. Okay? These are those languages or aspects of language even, which we tacitly assume to be well documented, but for which which documentation turns out, I'm getting ahead of myself. Then we have the blank spots, the known unknowns, excuse me. And then we have the unknown unknowns, what Rumsfeld was referring to. These are the things that we think are documented, or we assume to be documented, but turn out not to really be documented in that we can't actually find the documentation. So I'm going to refer to these for the sake of this presentation as unknown unknowns. Let me first go back to these known unknowns. This stuff is the bread and butter of language documentation. These are the languages for which we know little or no documentation exists. And an example is my work over the past few years with Western Tonta or Lama, a Papuan outlier language of Indonesia. When I started this work, the only extant documentation was a 117-item word list and a few notes on a napkin, literally, handed to me by Mark Donahue. This was a clear case of an inadequately documented language. It was a known unknown, a language about which we knew we did not know. So these are the major focus of our field, right? They are the tasks laid out for us, if you will. They are the motivation for developing explicit discovery strategies for endangered languages, which are discussed here at this conference even. We don't know enough about these languages, and since we don't know that we don't know enough, we can develop strategies for documenting them. So those are the known unknowns. What about the unknown unknowns? This is a more insidious problem, and I'm going to give an example today drawing on Alaska Native place names. These unknown unknowns are the things that arise when we mistakenly believe that a language is adequately documented or archived. And I think what happens here, just to look forward a bit, is that extended field work with a particular language or language family can lead to the impression of comprehensive documentation when in practice such documentation may not be readily retrievable. So if we think that a language is adequately documented, when in fact it is not, then in effect we don't know that we don't have adequate documentation. Starting to sound a bit Rumsfeldian there, but this is an unknown unknown. And so I first became aware of this problem over the past year or so while working on a revised version of the Alaska Native Languages map. This is a map many of you may be familiar with. It was first published in 1974 by Michael Krauss, revised in 1982. As part of the revision process, we decided to include indigenous place names, about 260 names across the state, mostly native villages and a few geographic features. The main objective of the project was to revise some of the language names on the map and to create a digital GIS layer for the language boundaries. The decision to include place names was something of an afterthought. It was not a main objective in the project. The idea is that we just would get the easy names, right? This wasn't going to be a comprehensive inventory. This was just going to be the easy names that, of course, we all knew, which should be easy to find. To give you some idea of comparison, if you look at some of the better documented areas in Alaska, you find a density of names which, if extrapolated across the whole state, would give you something like an expectation of nearly 40,000 names. Remember, we were looking for 260, right? Not 40,000. 260 should be easy, right? So, for comparison, if you look at the state of Alaska, it's about 170 million hectares. That the 260 names we're looking for is about 1.5 names per million hectares. A million hectares is about the size of Connecticut, Cyprus, something like that. If you look at just the Otna region, you heard something about Otna earlier today, maybe. That's one area of Alaska that's fairly comprehensively documented for place names. And the density there is about 234, so much higher. We're not looking for that kind of coverage, that sort of comprehensive coverage of place names. So surely these sort of things, these major names, like pictured here on this close-up of the revised language map, would be fairly easy to find. Well, here's the problem. The data aren't there. In spite of the fact that leading scholars of Alaska Native languages have been working on these languages for 30, 40, 50 years, and in spite of the fact that I had full access to the Alaska Native Language Archive, the most comprehensive archive of Alaskan language documentation, in spite of this, I wasn't able to locate all of the names to fill out this simple map of prominent Alaska place names. In fact, it turned out that for most of the 20 Alaska Native languages, there is no readily available authoritative reference, published or unpublished, for place names. Instead, gathering these 260 names required consulting multiple sources, contacting native speakers and linguists to verify the names. In many cases, there were disagreements. Extended research was required. And what began as a simple project that I thought might take a week or so ended up taking over a year. In other words, the simple project of data gathering from an archive turned into a primary research project. So where did all the names go? All these names that I knew were there that turned out not to be there. Well, how could this be? Part of the problem is that most place names research is not published or is published in some kind of gray literature. It isn't kind of the mainstream of linguistics in that sense. It's a kind of a subfield that tends to get buried and not promulgated very widely. In turn, I think a lot of this work tends not to be archived, right? Or it's archived on somebody's computer or underneath their desk or in a shoebox somewhere. A lot of this work is done by non-linguists who really don't have kind of a view towards seeing this as part of language. They see it as something else, something different from language, and maybe don't value the linguistic content. Another problem is when in attempting a project on the scale that I was doing is that much of this place names work is limited to a specific region or a language or a specific jurisdiction, like a village area. So that leads to large gaps in the data. or that necessitates consulting many different data sources. Another problem similar to this is that place names work tends to be project-oriented. Rather than focusing just on place names, it focuses on a larger projects, and then, oh, by the way, we'll do place names on the side. Sounds like what I was doing, right? A little bit of place names on the side of a larger project. Additional problem, similar to this, is that I think I just reversed these, that place names may focus on the knowledge of just one particular speaker or group of speakers, right? So this is, in a sense, embedded within a traditional ecological knowledge projects. We're looking at the knowledge of certain people or certain groups of people as opposed to the sum total knowledge of place names. And finally, there's the fact that place names data are special in the sense that they're quite fragile and easily lost. And today, in the interest of time, I'm going to focus on just these last two things and give an example of each of those just to illustrate that. The first project I want to talk about is the King Island Place Names Project. And this is an example of what you might call a larger project in which place names is embedded, within which place names is embedded. This was a large NSF-funded project that ran over a number of years. Intended to document the cultural geography, biogeography, and traditional ecological knowledge of King Island, which is a small island just off in the Bering Strait, about 200 hectares in size. This project was led by Deanna Kingston, and it's in many ways an exemplary project, community-driven, collaborative, very nice project. Larry Kaplan here has been a part of that project. So I no way mean to pick on this project. I want to point out something about the way this project documented place names. Here's some of these images are both from the website King Island Place Name, not with an S, .com. You see some of the participants in the project here. Documentation efforts were led by community members working in conjunction with anthropologists, linguists, and other experts. And they documented a total of 163 names in an area of less than 1,000 hectares. That makes King Island one of the most densely named regions in the North, if not the world. Many articles have been published. There's this beautiful website showing here. Website allows its users to click on a location, and you get information about the name. It includes a transcription, a photograph, and even an audio recording. Let's see if this will play. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't plug in, but you get the idea. There's a lot of rich information here stored. However, there is no way to actually get at the underlying data. There's no way to get to extract the underlying database that drives this. In other words, the location information for the place names. This wouldn't seem like such a big deal if the data were archived elsewhere. However, as far as I'm able to determine, they are not. And last I talked to Larry, I think we still didn't know the location of the actual GIS database that underlies this. Presumably it's discoverable, but it's one of those unknown unknowns. So again, I want to emphasize, I don't mean to criticize the King Island project in any way. In many ways, it's an exemplary project. What this demonstrates is that even the very best projects are not paying attention to the archiving of the underlying data. So here's a beautiful project that actually produced something. There's a lot of projects that don't even produce something like this and also don't have the underlying data. So what this shows is that even the best designed, most community-based, well-funded, collaborative projects can yield this impression that documentation is accessible when in fact it is not. So what we really are creating in this, in a sense, is something that's akin to a published grammar without the data. Right? We're putting the publication out, but the data is not available. Pretty pictures without an underlying data set. Let me move now to talking about this other problem that I referred to, the fact that place name data tends to be very fragile. This is this is a problem with place names, that they're often recorded directly on a map like this, that they're just written on as a location. So it's very easy for the link between the name and the location to be lost. It relies on this physical writing on the map, and that's often done in pencil and easily removed. It gets even worse, though. In many cases, this is an area of the lower Yukon, in the area called the Klyuch Flats, near Kaltag Portage, western Alaska. Place names are indicated on this map by small numbers. You may not be able to see them from the back, but the names are not directly written on the map. There's just a number that's been penciled in, and that number presumably corresponds somewhere to a name, and somebody once held a piece of paper that had that number and that name, but after much searching and even consulting the linguists who originally compiled this map, I have not been able to locate that original index. So the name and the location have become separated. So we have documentation of locations. We don't have documentation of the names. The two have become separated from each other. Now, a digital database, of course, can fix these things for us and render that problem not a problem, right? Well, not quite. Digitization attempts don't always solve the problem. So in particular, attempts to sort out this problem using GIS technology may also fail. So this is a database that was compiled a couple of years ago by a certain national park in Alaska. And each of the names is precisely located by latitude and longitude and so on. And there's a bunch of data in there. But I call your attention to this first piece here. You'll notice there are five places that are indexed with the number one. There are five number ones in this database, and presumably there is somewhere in a published report or a gray literature published by the National Park some index which tells me what number one is, but the problem is there are too many number ones. So how do I know which number one goes to which one? I can't tell. So it's really not that much better than the previous case I showed, except at least I've narrowed it down to five possibilities. So I could give a lot more examples like this. I came across so many of them in this last year, and it's really quite depressing to keep showing examples of this sort of thing. These are typical of what's out there in Alaska, at least. Let me just say real briefly, I'll just note that one thing you might ask is, our place name special? I would argue here that, at least in the Alaskan context, not. I don't think that place names are being sequestered here because of their kind of special status of place names knowledge or place names data in this case, although that might be the case in other parts of the world. In this case, I could access the information quite easily. It just wasn't very well put together, as I showed in the last two examples. So I won't dwell on this point in the interest of time, but let me just say real quickly that this phenomena happens at other in other domains as well. It's not restricted to place names. I'll just consider a few examples of unknowns in other domains of language documentation. If we stick with the theme of geography for a moment, consider the case of the native language map again. We might assume, looking at the map, that the mapping of isoglosses for Alaska native languages has already been completed. But in fact, if we look at the original original observations regarding phonological isoglosses in Alaska Athabaskan languages cannot be recovered from the published map of language boundaries. Some of the original data have appeared in publications. Some of it is retrievable in the Alaska Native Language Archive, but not all of it. And so there is data being lost, even though we assume that it is there. Plenty of cases of this in lexical documentation, and probably many of you are familiar with this, that original lexical documentation includes much more information than is in the published dictionary. Field notes, of course, is one of the most important areas of language documentation and description, but all too often these important documents are inaccessible in spite of the great information they can show. We tend to assume that field notes from language documentation exist, right? We all do field work, presumably, and collect such notes, but how can we be sure? Field notes may not count as documentation in the strict sense, but I think they are crucial to the exegesis of a linguist's work. So here we have a case where one of the most fundamental products of field research turns out, and go ahead and try if you're interested, but I think it turns out to, in most cases, to not be accessible. So, what can we do? Am I out of time, or do I still have a minute?
Not a minute.
Okay. In a minute, how can we respond? How can we deal with this problem? Well, I think the first thing we can do, and that's what I'm here to do today, is kind of say, hey, the problem exists. There are unknown unknowns. Donald Rumsfeld was right. And these things exist. But secondly, we can work to consolidate existing documentation, just as I've been doing with place names in Alaska. We can do this in other areas as well. But we also, I think, need to be more adamant about encouraging the archiving of primary data as best practice. And I think in this regard, funding agencies hold a major sway, and they could do a better job of ensuring that research which they fund ends up being properly archived and accessible. But in the end, I think it's up to us. We have to go out and discover these unknowns, unknown unknowns, and reclassify them either as known unknowns, if we can, that is by getting the documentation, or as known unknowns, and then they're laid out as tasks for us to go and document. So that which is documented but inaccessible should be considered to be undocumented. Knowing what we don't know allows us to make progress in filling gaps in documentation. So to do this, we need to know just what we do know by properly archiving the relevant documentation. Existence of material in an internationally recognized language archive should be the sine qua non supporting the assertion that a language has been adequately documented. Thank you. And I'll just point out that I had many, many collaborators on this work on the Alaska Native place names on the map, and you can find references and credits on the website there.
There's time for questions.
Peter.
I think there's another huge one, which you actually mentioned in passing through, which was we assume that linguist X went there and worked on the language, and therefore there must be some documentation.